The final year 2000. Marcus had got us through the Millennium Night, we were stronger for it, but still there were cash flow problems to resolve. It was obvious that if we went to cash and carry again, they would stop the account because of the rubber checks issued before Christmas. Marcus gave Stan his 500 quid back. Good job, because doormen are only your friends till you owe them money, then it's a completely different story. Stan, the man, had worked for me for 8 years. I had an understanding that I would never sack him no matter how bad things got, because he was the only one to come to my house and help fight off the bailiffs when I had a visit. The police and bailiffs were at my house emptying the contents into a white van. I asked Stan if he could prevent them going upstairs. He told the bailiffs in front of two coppers, "Look, mate, you don't go up these stairs or I will twat you. Do you get my drift?" The bailiffs stripped the downstairs, but all my radio equipment upstairs was not touched. Later that year, Stan had the same problem. He had money and had them round his house. I wrote Stan a letter saying he could use the amplifiers and music, but he must return them in original condition and that they belong to the nightclub. That letter saved Stan losing his entire record collection because I said it was club property. I got put in a tricky position when Stan asked for a pay rise, right at the time when I was skint. I said, "Look, Stan, where is the cash going to come from? We are empty most of the time." Stan, Deck and Richard did not see it quite like that. Tempers were getting frayed on the Friday night in February 2000. Our door staff saw it as me taking the piss. They were working till later and expected a higher rate after 2 a.m. It was smokescreen the following night. We were well used to Deck turning up an hour late, but Stan only lived up to the road, so it was alarming when he failed to show up. Marcus said, "We will delay the opening till 11 and see what happens." We had an enormous queue outside but had no doorman, so me and Marcus let the punters in slowly. Once we got them into the club, I phoned up a doorman agency and got temporary staff. This was the start of the doorman strike that was to last nearly a year. I said I would pay the agency staff in cash on the night. However, one of them got arsy. He said, "This place is bloody packed. How many does it hold? If you expect us to work over the fire limit, we want more cash." It was heaving. Smokescreen was the only night that filled the place, but it was not as good as it seemed because we had to split the door 50-50. I was left with the overheads. I said I would not be using those staff again. I put advert in the paper but only had three applicants. One was a colored chap, who had just come out of prison, we'll try to remember his name, and the other one was a chap who was very professional. He had finished his tour of duty in military police. A brilliant doorman, but just not up to the stature of Stan, Deck and Rich. The DLF football skinheads came in on the Friday night. They sensed a weakness because Deck and crew were gone. It kicked off, and I think I had to call the police. This was unheard of. I had to stand the military chap down, but I apologized to him and said I had made a recruiting error and in no way must he think that it was his fault. I really wanted to keep him in post, but I am sure I was exposing him to danger. I kept the colored chap because I wanted to show that giving someone a chance after prison was the right thing to do. He was a big bloke and could have been molded into part of a team. I asked Marcus if he knew anyone who could help. He said, "I will ask Keith and maybe my brother may do it." Keith and Marcus's brother started work the following week and worked with the colored chap whose name escapes me. The thing about Keith was that he was clever and studied law but came from the West End. I felt that he was always wanting to prove himself. However, whilst he worked for me, he did not question my judgment. I rather think that in his early days he had some respect for me. Keith would be there till the very end. He was someone to talk to when things turned to shit, which they definitely did. It was not long before our new team got a test, but they stood up well. It was again a smokescreen night. It was absolutely packed. At about 12-ish, I asked the doorman to do a full fire door inspection every 15 minutes. I used to do this inspection if we were grossly overloaded. Every 15 minutes, the doorman would inspect the fire exits for obstruction and sign a sheet to say they did it and alert me or Marcus of any problems. The idea behind this was if we had to evacuate the club, then we would not get caught out by sabotage. In the past, parked cars and large steel bins moved into exit doors. You could not be complacent when dealing with customers' lives. We had done the one-in-one-out thing, but we needed the cash. By slowing the rate of entry to the club, then at least the overload time could be minimized. Chris Marcus's brother carried up a collapsed woman. She was in the bottom corridor of the central stairs. Either her friends called an ambulance or we did, can't remember. Bearing in mind that I had foiled a drug raid on Smokescreen years previously, the old Bill were aware of what Smokescreen was about. This was by far our biggest night, 700 punters. We used to finish at about 2 a.m. Just as we were cleaning up the room after a busy night, the police turned up. We were told that this was a crime scene and we were to leave immediately. Blue and white tape and a roadblock was placed outside on Babington Lane. During this time we were on bailiff alert, so at the end of each night we would hide some sound equipment and lock all the furniture in the cloakroom. The police asked me for the keys to the nightclub. I gave them up and never got them back. At the roadblock we asked the police what this was all about. This is where they got clever. They said that a girl was fighting for her life in hospital. She had been injured by a sharp edge on a metal chair and it had punctured her lungs. This was disturbing because I was aware we had stored amongst the furniture in the cloakroom was broken stools awaiting disposal or repair. They did not get put out in the club, but we could not prove that because all the chairs were in there. I see this as very sinister on the part of the police. In the space of an hour, they had found a way of putting me in an almost undefaceable position. The reason for doing this was to put us off the real scent. That was that this was a drugs overdose, and I rather think they hoped she would die so they could stitch us up. Me and Marcus knew the story of the chair was made up, but nevertheless we had to listen to the local news like everyone else to see what cracked off. It was found that she had taken a horse tranquilizer instead of an ecstasy tablet and survived. The police decided to give advice on the radio Derby about safe use of drugs, and we heard nothing about this again. I did not get the keys back and had to get new ones cut. It was a lesson that the police will find a vulnerability and exploit it. They are not stupid. This was done at a high level and it was a warning that they had woken up. I remember taking the arty broken stool that was my souvenir from the dial to the tip, and throwing it over the wall. It was a metal tulip type thing made at the university. This was our last involvement with the police. They did not come back again, but I was glad. This episode made them more of a threat if they were going to use noble cause corruption on us.